I had been fired for the third time from a political talk radio slash internet outlet. And my career as a comic was pretty dried up. I was in the middle of a divorce. I was broke. And I really just didn't feel like I had many options. I'd run out of choices. I was incredibly depressed. I was emotionally depleted. And I was going broke rather rapidly.
That's comedian and podcaster Mark Maron. You'd never know it from what you just heard, but Maron found a way to resurrect himself from the ruins of his career as a failed stand-up comic. In fact, he says comedy saved his life. After he was fired from his most recent job, Maron decided to record some conversations with the people he knew best, comedians. The interview went on to become one of the top-ranking comedy podcasts on iTunes and averaged 400,000 downloads a week. It's called WTF. These days, Maron's career is in high gear. His podcast is going strong, and he's back in the stand-up circuit again. Steve Paulson asked Maron if his old reputation as an angry guy with an axe to grind made it hard for other comedians to open up to him.
Well, you know, comics are a unique bunch of people. We're all sort of misfits and social outcasts and awkward and self-involved. I mean, you know, it takes a certain disposition to get into comedy. And I think that emotionally we share a lot of things. You know, some of us are angry. Some of us are depressed. Some of us are addictive personalities. Some of us are just megalomaniacal, but it's all sort of the same wheelhouse. And I think that once the podcast started going, they realized that they could have an honest conversation about who they are and what they do. And I think that was attractive to comics. And I think that despite the fact I was angry, a lot of them knew me and a lot of them understood where I was at and had some respect for me.
And we should point out, these comics are sitting down with you in your garage.
Yes.
Is there something magical about the garage?
It's starting to seem that way, isn't it, Steve?
I mean, this is not a fancy garage, is it?
Well, no, it's kind of this beat-up garage out back. It's a single-car garage. I mean, the house was built in probably 1924, and like I put a floor in there, and all my books are out there. It's pretty cozy. It's something I've always wanted. I wanted it to become what it is, not necessarily a studio, but kind of like a, I guess they'd call it a man cave. You know, there's a magic quality to it. It's pretty cozy.
Now, the episode that really put you on the map was your conversation with Robin Williams. And this was not the usual Robin Williams that we've heard, sort of that, you know, hyperdrive manic Robin Williams. He was actually pretty laid back and real. Can you tell me about that interview?
Well, you know, he's a pretty sweet guy when you hang around. He was always, oddly, fairly accessible when you run into him at a comedy club or something and you sit and chat with him. If there's not too many people around, he's almost shy and very sweet. And I think that once he agreed to do it, you know, I drove up to his place up in the Bay Area. It was 11 in the morning. It was at his home. There was no one there. It was just the two of us with two microphones. And I don't think that there was anyone really to perform for. And I think he was at a point in his life where he'd had a relapse on alcohol. He'd had heart surgery. You know, he was looking at some darkness and, you know, he'd gone through a divorce. And there was a vulnerability there that I certainly understood. And I think that he was ready to talk about and to talk about it in a candid way.
You know, you've had all this stuff and that you know, there really is a certain degree of like, it doesn't matter.
Big time.
It just doesn't matter.
That's the kind of the freedom, the ultimate freedom of letting go in a weird way. Like when you talked about all this stuff, you know, the that they say about you. I know it's out there, and it used to be it would immobilize me,
and now it would hurt your feelings.
Oh, it hurts everything. You just kind of go, well, I shouldn't perform. Then going, no, you love performing. Go out and perform. People will say good things. People will say bad things. It's the nature of the world. It's like you say, if it's like Tina Fey once said, if you're ever feeling really good about yourself, there's this thing called the internet. Now at this point in your life, going on stage, being around people you have a good time with, and seeing people like Pearl, seeing people like Overton. And hanging out with friends, and you go, oh, God. And hanging with you, even when we're at the Comedy Cellar, going upstairs and just riffing, go, that's worth it to me more than worrying about, oh, how am I doing?
And there's another kind of conversation that you sometimes have where you start out apologizing to your guest because maybe you had trouble with this person in the past, and you sort of, you know, are upfront about it. You're kind of laying it all out there.
Well, I have to do that. I don't know. A lot of times when I do that, there are a lot of people that I've had problems with in the past, a lot of people that I felt like I owed apologies for. But you have to understand that sometimes I will hold on to one meeting, you know, that happened 15 years ago that I still remember as me being a bastard of some kind. And sometimes people remember it, sometimes they don't. But there are deeper difficulties. I mean, like with me and Louis C.K.
I was going to ask about that.
Well, that was a strained relationship for a long time. You know, I love the guy.
And you go way back to him. I mean, you both sort of started out as comics together, right?
Yeah. I've known him a long time. And I always had a pretty deep emotional connection to him, and I think he to me. And we always were able to sort of lock in when necessary and walk each other through things. But we sort of lost touch, and my envy got the best of me. And we just didn't talk to each other. And it was difficult. So when I did those interviews, that was some pretty real stuff to try to kind of navigate and renegotiate a friendship, to try to save a friendship.
You know, we had our friendship faded away at some point, and I had time when I was writing you emails to connect with you personally.
Yeah.
And you were ignored me.
Really?
Yeah, for a long time. For, I don't know, over a year.
Really?
Longer than that, yeah. Ugh. You just wouldn't answer me. And I would write emails that said, I'm not sure why you're not writing me back, but I'm going to persist because our friendship goes back far enough.
Right, I remember that.
Saving.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't answer me.
What the
fuck
was my
problem? At some point, I caught you on the phone and you said that you felt like when we talk, it's just about me and I don't really listen to you, that I'm very self-centered.
Right.
And I took that to heart. But I also thought, well, I felt like it was unfair.
You know, it almost sounds like some of these podcasts kind of function like therapy. You know, people getting stuff off their chest and for some reason telling it to the world, at least those people who follow you, gets rid of something out of their deep black box.
Sometimes. There have been times where people come to it with different expectations. Some people are willing to talk. Some people want to talk. But a lot of times, like I said, these are thoughtful people. The Todd Hanson episode around this type of conversation that you and I are having was really the most profound as an event. And I think a lot of times...
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, Todd Hanson was really the original head writer of The Onion for most practical purposes. He was there at the ground floor, you know, comes from up in your area.
Right.
I'd known him for years, and I'd always liked him. We didn't talk much, but, like, we were all in the same circle. And I had scheduled an interview with him in New York. I was there for a few days doing a live WTF in Brooklyn. And I said, look, let's do an interview. Let's do this. Why don't you meet me at my hotel? So Todd comes over to the hotel, and he basically says, yeah, I've been to this hotel before. And this is off mic, and I said, what do you mean? He goes, I came here, and I checked in, and I had no intention of checking out. So off mic, I said, well, what are we going to do here? Are we going to talk about this, or what do you want to do? And he goes, I don't know. I don't know. So we did the interview. And we talked for an hour about The Onion, about its impact, about, you know, where it came from, where he came from. And at the end, he just said, look, maybe we have more to talk about another time, but I really appreciate, you know, whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. So that was the end of that interview. And I just kind of held on to it. I said, look, you know, if you want to talk about this, the other thing, we can do a second part to this. And he's like, okay, I'll think about it. So I didn't put up that first interview. I just held on to it. And a few months later, yeah, you know, he said, I think I can talk about it. So I said, okay. So I met him at his apartment, and he, you know, he walked me through that day and those feelings and the repercussions of taking that action and how it affected him and others and how he felt now. And I posted those two together. Now, what we talked about, though, that that you wanted to make sure that we talked about.
I just wanted to say I'm sorry to all those people. I mean,
about the selfishness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I mean, I talked about this a little bit, that I had left this note saying, oh, you know, I'm really sorry. But that wasn't good enough, you know? It's a selfish thing to do, to take people's love and not give it back, you know? And if you abandon them, then all of the investment of love that they gave you is, you just transmute it into pain, and it's not fair to them. So, I mean, not only do I thank all of those people, but I also apologize to them. I mean, I've said this to all of them many times, and they're sick and tired of hearing it, to be honest, but I just thought it was important to say, not only thank you, but I'm sorry. And it will not happen again.
And that had a profound effect on me, on hundreds and hundreds of listeners who sent emails, who had dealt with that, those feelings themselves, or had family members that they could never understand how that family member could do that or try to do that. And it just shed a lot of light in a very intimate way on a profound, horrible human reality that is completely selfish and mysterious to people that don't have those kind of feelings.
Now, we started out by talking about where you were when you first created WTF. I mean, you know, your life was a wreck at that point, and things have totally changed. I mean, the podcast is a huge hit. You do a lot of stand-up comedy. I know you've had negotiations about a TV show. Is it fair to say that comedy has saved your life again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It saved my life in a very unusual way, in that I did it. No one, you know, gave me an opportunity. No one, you know, hung any sort of expectation on me. No one said, well, we're going to run this guy up the pole and see if anyone takes. Like, it was not, I'm the top of the food chain here. You know, the pride that comes from creating something successful, really with your own hands and your own mind, and taking some risks and earning a little money from it is something I never have experienced before. And it feels, I'm very grateful for it, but it just, to feel like you've earned your money and that you've earned your success is something I never thought I would feel, you know, just by virtue of how my brain is built. But it's more than I could ever ask for, and it just blows my mind, because I was washed up, buddy, and that's a reality.
So given what you've been through over the last 5 years or so, I'm wondering if you have any advice for people, comic or not, whose life has bottomed out, about how to climb out of that pit.
Well, you know, and I'm in a different position than a lot of people. Because of whoever I am and whatever problems I have, you know, I am 2 divorces into life. I have no children. The dependent issue was a lot less than a lot of other people who are having trouble, and they have certain responsibilities. But I do know that you have to fight through that pride and through that sense of failure. You have to somehow manage to get past that cycle of self-criticism and self-abuse for whatever you think went wrong in your life, and put it aside and try to do what's in front of you and do whatever you have to do to live your life and get back up on some sort of level ground. And I know it's hard for people right now. My brother is a great example, is having a tremendous amount of difficulty because of the market, because of jobs. He's got a large family. And I don't really know what to say to him other than it's happening to a lot of people. And we all had expectations about how our life was going to turn out, or how we wanted it to turn out, or what we were entitled to. But a lot of that isn't happening for a lot of people. And it's really not their fault. And you just have to adapt to what's going on right now for you and for the country, and just realize that you can be disappointed, but what's important is that you're alive, you're healthy, you got people that love you and depend on you, is to not ruin all that because you think you failed. Because that's the stuff that's going to get you through this.
Comedian Marc Maron talking about how to bounce back from failure and his hit comedy podcast, WTF. Steve Paulson spoke with him.